It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Today's podcast is presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way for you to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. I recently joined as a member and you can too. Apply today to become a member and immediately be connected with advertisers that fit your audience. That's podgo.co at podgo.co. And remember to include the name The Scoreless Thriller Podcast in your application. Thank you.
Man there trying to stop Grover getting himself into further trouble.
It's a fucking disgrace!
Oh, it's not a bad ball for Pelle on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. And what a great goal that was! Carlos Alberto!
Maradona just walked away from Huddle then. Maradona. Open.
Met het balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal. Heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan. Dennis Bergkamp.
Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp.
Oh! Frank de Boer speelt de bal naar Dennis Bergkamp. Die neemt de bal feilloos aan. En hij schiet de bal erin.
Welcome to the first ever book club episode of the Scoreless Thriller Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Leon. Leon, how are you doing?
I'm super excited to be here today.
And down the line in Zoom, we're joined by Paul Watson. Just going to read your LinkedIn page. published author and freelance journalist, editor and copywriter, and international football coach. Is that what you go by as the first line?
That's what... Yeah, I was a bit thrown though that I forgot I had a LinkedIn page. So that was a good moment. Yeah, I guess I was a former international football coach, I suppose. Yeah, although kind of, you know.
Yeah, and on this week's episode of the podcast, we're going to be discussing Up Pompeii, which was written by Paul Watson, which charts his course through coaching the Pompeii national team, which we have both read and greatly enjoyed. How long did it take you to get the correct pronunciation of Pompeii, and how many like different ways have you tried?
You know, the funniest thing about it is that it took me a long time to get the wrong pronunciation, in that it's technically Pompeii. The island's name is Pompeii, and I used to call it Pompeii, and then when I went there, I found pretty much all the locals, or all the people I worked with, always said Pompeii, because it saves that extra second, and when you add that up over the course of a year, you save about a day. It was kind of funny before you went there. I'd never heard of it, obviously, and everyone says Pompeii. You know, the volcanic mountain. Everyone says that.
And from reading the book, it's clear that time management is very important to the Pompeii people.
Yeah. I guess there's never been a place place that has got more time to waste probably than there. But yeah, it's a really strange thing that that sort of marks you out as almost marked me out as a foreigner by trying to pronounce it correctly.
Okay, but that's good to know. Then we won't be scared. It's either Ponape or Pompey. Yeah. We'll run with whatever works best for us, I guess.
Well, let's go back to the beginning and start from there. And if you want to kind of flesh out where the idea to move your life across the world and take up coaching the Pompey national team, what was the kind of seed which started that whole idea and process?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's probably a conversation most people have had, you know, crazy football fans have had at some point, that you know, me and my flatmate at the time, Matt, we sort of got to a stage in our lives where we were technically adults. We were 25, but we'd never properly grown up and moved on from that childhood thing of thinking one day we're going to play for England, you know, one day we'll make it as footballers. There were a lot of signs we wouldn't, such as being not particularly good at football and the fact that I was kind of trying to make it at kind of low semi-pro level in the UK, so sort of seventh division of the UK, and failing to do that. But still, it got to this point at 25 and both had a bit of a crisis. And what it led to was this conversation that I think millions of football fans have had of, well, look, we can't play for England. It's never going to happen. Even in 2008, even under Steve McLaren, we couldn't play for England. But, you know, wait a minute. What if we'd been born in, and, you know, the example we usually come to is something like Andorra or San Marino, because you see them in qualifiers and think, well, how hard can that be? And basically what we did, which I think most people don't do because they have something better to do, is take it to its kind of ridiculous conclusion and not just stop at Andorra and think, well, yeah, actually, we wouldn't get in that team, but go all the way down to the very bottom of the rankings and even beyond the ranking to find where you could play.
Yeah, yeah, I like that part in the book when you said, so, okay, we kind of checked out the players with the lowest ranking teams, and now we found out we have to move beyond the FIFA rankings. We have to find someone who is not even on it. And then,
at the very bottom, this is the thing. I mean, we're going back a few years now, so the teams we mentioned at the bottom aren't anymore at the bottom. In fact, Montserrat are now doing much better than they ever have. But at the time we were looking, you'd see these names and think, well, how hard can it be to play for, you know, Bhutan? And actually, you know, if you actually saw the quality of some of these players, you'd think, that's no way on earth. And you keep running across a player who'd played in, you know, English third division here or there or something, you'd think, oh, no way that we're going to a training session with them and not getting found out pretty fast.
Yeah. So then this was the spark, this was the initial idea. But then my question would be, how do you actually manage to put this into practice? Because there's so many plans that one has in one's life where you know that it is kind of crazy and out there, but it would be nice to follow through with it, but then you never manage. And then with your story, I think it's very inspiring that this is like the one time that someone actually does it.
Yeah, well, I guess, and sure enough, it's just dumb luck. Basically, we got to the end of the FIFA rankings. We discovered there was a non-FIFA rankings list for places that don't qualify for FIFA recognition, for whether it's political reasons or whether it's just simply they never had a team, or they're one, in Pompeii's case, it's one island out of four that should make up a country, but they're separated by thousands of miles.
Yeah.
They put it together. And we found this list, went to the very bottom, found Pompeii listed because they'd never won a game of any kind, and they'd recently lost to their nation, their nearest neighbours, yeah, on penalties, I think. But before that, they'd lost 16-1 to Guam. And basically, we sent an email to the FA email address, which we thought would never, ever reply to us. And you know, we could go about our lives completely happy to, you know, that was the end of the process.
Yeah.
The thing that was crazy was that we got a reply, and the reply basically said, from this guy called Charles Musana, who'd lived there for 15, 20 years, as the football, kind of main football man, said, I'd love to help you, but I've just moved to London. And that was, you know, at the time we were living in London, so it was the craziest thing. He kind of said, you know, meet up, we can meet up and have a chat. And, you know, all the coincidences, he happens to have moved 9,000 miles to London, but 9,000 miles to London. And we met up, you know, up with him and had a curry with him. And that was probably, that coincidence changed it from being a stupid thing to something that could happen, because what he told us was, kind of, you know, he saw us for what we were and said, look, you know, I don't think you're stupid enough to really think this is a sensible plan. He didn't say it as horribly as that. But, honestly, guys, you know,
lads, what are you thinking?
Yeah. No, I think he basically said, look, I've spent a long time trying to develop football on this island. I've left now. I feel really sad that I can't do that anymore. You know, you can't go out and play for this team. I think you kind of know that, but yeah, you know, football's really dropped off, and I think it needs someone to go and run it. And you know, if you want to do that, by all means. And I think he kind of said that as one of those rhetorical things. It's kind of a throwaway comment. You know, if you want to go do that, of course, and expect it to never hear anything more from
yeah,
us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that was kind of the moment we needed, because I think at heart, you know, we'd looked into the realities of naturalising, and you can't really naturalise for any country very easily, and you certainly can't naturalise for Federated States of Micronesia without giving up your passport and your UK passport and marrying and learning the language and living there 5 years. So
that's
all of that.
Quite a list, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas if you're going to become the coach of a country, quite obviously they don't have that rule. Otherwise, you wouldn't have many foreign national coaches around. So it kind of felt like for us it was a moment of growing up, because it was like, well, actually, you know, this sounds like more than just a stupid drunk anecdote. There's actually something we could do.
Yeah. And then at one point, you just bought the tickets for the flights.
Well, yeah,
there.
As I always say to people, if this was a Hollywood movie, we'd have got on that flight the next week. But the reality was, I had a job, you know, a girlfriend, a job, and no money. So for me, it was like saving up for a year to raise the money. And actually, what was good about that was it gave me a year to learn how to coach, or try to learn how to coach.
Yeah.
I don't know, I did it very effectively, but basically I had a year of writing every single session down, trying to learn what I was doing, and just learning from the coaches. And strangely, even though at the time I was playing, I'd given up on semi-pro, I went to an amateur team, and actually ended up having a coach who'd been a Cagliari player in Serie A, and he was this amazing sort of Italian coach who was way too good for that level. And you know, every session I would learn and learn and learn, and I kind of saw it as a bit of a rebirth in football, because I was never a good footballer, and I'd always tried to make up for that with just being as fit as I could and kind of getting by. But it was kind of a rebirth to think, well, actually, maybe I could be a good coach. You know, there's no physical reason. Whereas as a footballer, I could never have made it. I just didn't have that talent. So yeah, it was kind of an exciting moment.
Yeah, definitely. How important do you think it was that you had this, it was kind of a joint endeavor with Matt, so that you had someone by your side who was equally eager to make this happen, and not just you by yourself, you know, having these weird ideas of going somewhere abroad to become a football coach?
Yeah, I never would have done it alone. I think I've told people afterwards, like, I wouldn't even eat in a restaurant alone. So, like,
I remember reading that, yeah.
There was something about that thing that when one of us would maybe start to lose the determination or start to think this is crazy, the other one would then happen to fall into a spell where they were like, this is the best idea ever. Like, we'd have one voice of reason and one, and it wasn't always one way or the other way. It was, you know, it was really good to have the two of us doing it. And I think we both always thought, you know, if one of us kind of can't manage it, the other one can take over in that. So with me and Matt's a brilliant sort of, he's just very full of energy. He's the life and soul of the party. He's like a big, charismatic, big old, like, 6'3" monster of a man.
Yeah.
I'm very quiet and a bit shy and 5'10". I'm the kind of person you can meet and forget very quickly, whereas Matt, you don't. So we had these two things. He was the kind of, he was the, like, the big explosive one, and I was the quiet, pensive one. And we kind of needed both of us to make it work, I think.
Yeah. And then, so when you both decided to go, like, what was your first kind of impressions of the island and also of football when you got there? Like, what did you do? Did you immediately want to get back on the plane and go home, or what?
No, not at all. And actually, I look back at it, it's 10 years ago now, so it's hard through time sometimes to remember bits and pieces. But what I do remember is, so getting there, the biggest fear we had was someone else would get there ahead of us. And it sounds as crazy as you might, as it sounds, you know, that was our biggest fear, was we'd get there and there'd be some third-rate English manager out there who's much better than us. And get out there and meet David Moyes. But what we had was we got there and we were really worried that it was too much for us, because we went with Charles Musana, the guy who'd run football. So he came with us. We said, look, we'll not only will we save up for our flights, we'll pay for your flights. We'll bring you over with us, because otherwise, how are we gonna get to know everyone?
Yeah.
So Charles was pointing back to us, like, everyone's massively keen. Everyone's really excited. And so we got there thinking there's going to be hundreds of people. We're going to get found out. In fact, we're really inexperienced. We don't know what we're doing. So we got to this island, and you know, you've been flying for 26 hours. The whole journey takes 30 hours. It includes sort of a couple of stays on airport floors and stuff like that. So you get there and you feel pretty dreadful. Mm-hmm. But that night, you know, 2 hours later, we're going off to the field. And so the first impression is like, we're exhausted, but this island is just beautiful, it's tropical, it's hot, it's incredibly hot, and suddenly all the tiredness sort of dropped away, and it was more just the fear of, God, we're going to get there and have 150 people look at us and go, okay, what are we doing? We don't know what we're doing. So the reality, when we got to the field, there was one person. And it was this weird mixture of like relief and also, oh, did we just travel the length of the world for nothing?
Yeah, did you have all your training sessions like set out for everything, and then
So being the kind of big, very much a typical Englishman, you know, real like over plans, I had filled out notebook after notebook with drills and exercise and all the stuff you think you got to do to be a coach when you're not a coach. So I turned up with 15 sessions ready to go. If we have 8 people, if we have 70 people, if we have, and sure enough, none of it was useful. Not any of it at any point. But I always felt that's what you have to do. It was like a learning process about coaching in general. Is, you know, you don't coach in a notebook. You coach people who are physically present. And it was almost like the first bit of learning that was turning up with my plan for 50 people, 100 people, and there being one.
And a lot of toads.
So it was a really interesting experience. So what we ended up doing was, eventually, as we learned, people are very late on the island all the time. It's, you know, a well-known phenomenon, island time. We didn't know it. An hour later, after the time they told everyone, we had about 12 people. Eventually, we got about 14, 16 people. Some of them had played lots. Some of them had not played much at all. And we just had a kick around. And it was this beautiful, you know, it was dark by that point. There was one floodlight working, but it was like sort of tropical night, really hot. The pitch was completely flooded, as it always is, with, you know, frogs hopping around, flooded pitch.
Yeah.
And it was this amazing experience, you know. And in a way, in that one night, I sort of felt, okay, you got to stop expecting everything to be like England. You know, this is going to be something completely different. But if you go with it, maybe it'll be something really special.
Yeah, and also during that first coaching, or that first match, you said that Roger, who also played, that he had no impact on the game, but nonetheless a grin never left his face. And I thought that was quite an interesting way, or beautiful way, of describing this approach of the Islanders to football before it was professionalized or anything happened. And then based on this idea, my question would kind of be, do you think... in the process of becoming more and more professional, and also maybe trying to make athletes out of the players that were there, do you think something is lost by this becoming more of a competitive thing? Or is it possible to combine these two things, where this one aspect and element of it is just like pure happiness and joy, and the other one is kind of this idea of, okay, we want to be competitive and win matches?
That's a really good point. It's a really good point. And one of the big things we learned was that we had to learn from the island. You know, we were learning more there than they were learning from us, obviously. But, you know, that goes without saying. But you go in, and what I learned from the island was basically there was this love and this joy of playing. But also there were things about the nature of players, the way the Pompeians approached football, that were actually really beneficial. And what we didn't want to do was set about training out of it and making a crappy English Sunday league team out of these players, because not only would that be detrimental in terms of their enjoyment of the game, if we made a sort of 4-4-2 football, you know, stodgy English team out of them, but also we'd actually be making a much weaker team than the team that they had. They had these attributes that were really, you know, amazing attributes, but they would be trained out of you at an early age in England by the fear of failure, by the fear of being responsible for conceding a goal, all those kind of things I remember learning as a 7-year-old, 8-year-old. You don't get caught in possession, hoof it out of the field rather than get caught in possession.
Yeah, yeah, it's the same here in Germany, exactly the same thing. You're the last defender.
And it's amazing because, yeah, and you're dealing with this idea that, oh, wait a minute, we don't have to put this fear into them. You know, it's so it was always a bit of a balance. Like, we tried to make a team that could function in a competitive sense, but also where they didn't lose that love of the game, they didn't lose all those attributes. And it was a balancing act, because I think we did have to trim out some of the elements of that. But I think that came later on when, you know, at first it was all about participation. So we just wanted to, we set up a league, we just had people playing for fun. And it was all just fun-based, it was participation. And it was only actually when we got to the point where the players were saying, look, we need something to play for. The real, like, most keen players who were coming every day to the field were like, we need a target, you know, we need a game. Once we set a game and a fixture, those players that were coming day in, day out actually wanted to feel more like, you know, a professional environment. They wanted to feel like they were elite athletes, and they were all pushing us to give them more structure. And so we really did mold them more into a team that could, you know, that could compete off the island. But it's funny because even at that point, I was really reticent to try and put that fear into them, and a lot of it was the mentality. Their mentality, they'd only ever seen teams go off the island and get thrashed, so a lot of the players really needed to not have that fear, to be almost the opposite, to be kind of coached into feeling that they could succeed.
Yeah.
So it really was a difficult balance when they'd do something that you'd be like, oh my god, don't do that.
Can you give an example of, like, what was, because I think you mentioned in the book that you saw them at the start, when you saw them play football, like, it didn't look like any kind of football that you'd ever seen before, because it was like football outside of the kind of social, cultural kind of, like, confines or, like, norms of what you would view as football normally.
I mean, some of the very early games, it was a mixture, because some of the players had played a lot and had trained under Charles Massana, the guy who brought us there, and some of them were really, you know, good footballers who obviously had a very firm grasp of the rules and how to play. And then others were real novices, had just seen their mates playing, usually had dropped by to take the piss out of their mates, because that's like one of their favourite activities. As turn up, your mate do something they're not good at, take the piss. But then it kind of got dragged into playing, and some of them were playing quite literally for the first time ever. So they would do something like catch the ball and hoof it into the car park. there was that whole level, and you know, the sliding head first into someone's knee was quite a popular tactic at one point. And, you know, there were just things that you thought, wow, that's mental. But in the middle of that was something incredible, like some skill that you thought, wow, how's anyone learned that here?
Yeah.
So it was an incredible mixture. And I think as the league happened, players got more regulated, I guess, because part of the league process was teaching the local guys how to referee, how to officiate, so they would officiate their own games rather than it being one white guy running around telling him what to do, which was never a good look. We would try and get people bought into it. So as that went on, it sort of standardised what the game looked like a lot more, which was, you know, which was kind of a big factor in this kind of elite squad becoming more like a team that would be able to go off the island and compete.
I've got one quick question, because while I was reading the book, I was so excited about the league and the league starting. And then you never get to know what the final table actually is.
Yeah, who won the league?
Yeah, no, I think we know, like, Red Bulls, they win the league. But then who comes second, and what's the final table?
Oh, you're testing me now. 10 years ago.
I know it's a lot to ask, but, oh, man.
I can tell you for sure the Pit Bulls won.
Yeah.
That was the team which ended up having more or less, like, maybe three quarters, four fifths of the national team. So it was, or the state team, it was pretty much like Juventus in 2006, you know. It was probably like the team, and Dilshan, who was our captain, was the captain of that team, and was just, you know, they were full of great players. But then the second place team, I believe, was I believe it's either my team, the international team that I played for. I think it might have been International FC. Which was this, like, glorified ragtag of players, mostly people who were, like, you know, expats on the island, people who were like 40, 45, just sometimes, I think I tell the story in the book of cruising for footballers and just going into bars and looking for men who might be able to play football and how odd that process was.
Yeah, knocking on the doors of the Mormons and everything.
Oh, and cold calling the Mormons. Yeah, so we did cold call the Mormons at their Mormon hut to try and get them to play football. And, you know, this process of assembling teams was very haphazard, but the Island Pickles were by far and away the strongest. And then I think International FC may have finished second in that year. Then the College of Micronesia, I think, which was the university team, was pretty good. Those Seventh-day Adventists weren't bad either, so they were a religious group on the island who had a team. It was an amazing thing watching that league all come together. I'm very fond of the memory of it, and I remember one of my proudest moments was watching, well, playing against, as an International FC player, playing against the Island Pitbulls, who I was coaching the players of for the state team, and watching them absolutely run rings around me and thinking, okay, we're getting somewhere now.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounded like the first big step also in the book. And then I felt like there was a turning point kind of in the whole story was when you get to know Dilshan, because then he has got so much local knowledge of all the talents, but also of kind of the politics that you have to play in order to set this up. It really feels like he was the enabler for this bigger thing happening, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And without Dilshan, there was none of this would have happened. So basically, to kind of tell the story to people who won't have read it, which is everyone outside of my family and you guys. basically, Dilshan wasn't Pompeii, and he'd lived there for years and years. He's Sri Lankan. His family had moved there shortly after the Civil War. His family had moved out to Pompeii. He was a cricketer, maybe even on course to play for the national team of cricket, like a brilliant cricketer, played for Sri Lanka. And then, obviously, there's no cricket in Pompeii, so he took up football. And he had basically single-handedly, since Charles Musana had sort of dropped back a little bit, he had been coaching these guys day in, day out. And suddenly we'd arrived. And, you know, for Dilshan, it's just like the craziest result for him. It's like an amazing thing to happen, partly because he overestimated how good we were at everything, but partly I think he thought, well, look, this is my chance. So he was kind of he had this amazing role where he was local enough that he could talk to the players and they respected him, liked him, he was a friend, he was seen as Pompeian in most ways. He could even speak quite a lot of the local language. But he was also foreign enough that he could come to me and understand when I would say to him, what's going on here? So it was this perfect middle ground where me and Dilshan would just drive around all day doing tasks, you know, putting these things together. And I would often say to him, can we do this? And he'd say, no. And I'd say, why can't we do this? He'd say, that would be a grave insult. You'd never be spoken to again by that person. I'd be like, oh, okay.
Bullet dodged.
Yeah, exactly. So he would do this amazing sort of middle point where I could run things by him. And likewise, if the players wanted to know something from me, they were often quite shy in the early days.
Yeah.
They didn't want to talk to authority. They were a bit shy. So they would ask him and he would come to me and I'd go to him. So we always had this way of relating that he had this perfect central figure. And so when he became captain, it was the ideal relationship that I always felt he would be honest with me and say, look, you know, and he did time and time again. He said, the players think this, you know, the players think this is crazy, the players don't understand why you're doing this, the players think this. Even through to him saying, at one point, the players think you're 50 years old. But it was all these things where it was like, and it really helped. It really, really helped. And one of the big things that Dilshan was able to do was, because a lot of his friends were the players, and because I didn't have a lot of friends there, Matt actually had to go back home pretty early on. So I was left with just Dilshan. And what he could do is bring me into the social situations with the players. And so what actually helped the most was when I'd gone there trying to be as professional as I could to impress the players and think, well, that's what you do. And actually it was when I was at my least professional that actually I won them over. So the times that we'd go out drinking or go out to an island and have barbecue, get stoned, and, you know, those were the times the players actually ended up liking me, and you know, that was the craziness.
Although Dilshan doesn't drink, right?
Not officially. There's a few things in the book.
The big reveal on the pod.
Exclusive.
I'm saying Dilshan can't drink very well.
Yeah, because I remember there was one at the end of the book, like he, after the whole Guam trip, he won't take off his sunglasses. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe he actually was on a night's out before that.
Oh, they all got, I mean, Guam,
yeah.
What we had, like, this group of young lads. I mean, the Guam to Pompeians is like Las Vegas, you know, it's like the bright lights, the most exciting thing. So we've taken this group of lads, most of whom had never been off the island, to basically the like Sin City of the region. So we just kept them on the tightest leash for that entire tour.
Yeah.
But we always said from the last night, you just do whatever you want to do, because me and Matt were going to go off and get drunk, and like, we didn't want the responsibility of like having them with us.
Yeah.
But we wanted to let them off the leash, they deserved it, but we didn't want to know what they did. So that next day, of course. Just looking at them all at the airport, like, but yeah, no, Dilshan, me and Dilshan would often go for a few beers in the bar, and you know, it was a really good way to unwind. It's just, you know, me and him would just go for drinks in the evenings and sort of plot over a beer in a nice bar overlooking the ocean. It was a pretty good time, really.
Yeah, sounds like it. I mean, there's one thing I'd like to go back to, though, because you said earlier that a lot of the players saw you as kind of an authority in a way. And when I was reading the book, also you even mentioned in the book this idea of football connected to imperialism, and this is maybe also part of this bigger scheme within FIFA, where FIFA gives money to certain states and not to others, and the question like why and what is the motivation behind it and what's the politics behind it. But like, maybe more towards your own personal story, how does it feel if you, as a guy from Britain, goes to a different country? And then, I mean, you've got maybe the money and the education, and then you teach them how to do a certain sport. Do you think there's any tension there sometimes? I mean, I think you do because you wrote it in the book. But how did this play out? What were the difficult parts there?
It's really interesting you say that. I mean, it's funny because at the time I was very young and naive, and I don't think when I was 25, I don't think it really massively crossed my mind. I wasn't particularly political. I wasn't particularly well versed in history of, you know, colonial history or anything. So it wasn't a huge part of my thinking at the time.
Yeah.
It more self-regulated that. I'd like to think I'm a fairly sensitive and I'm not a guy who goes and barrels into places and believes that they know everything. And you know, so I felt like I went over with the best of intentions. And so I didn't have, I'd like to think I didn't really have a very colonial sort of outlook on the world.
Yeah.
And so therefore I don't think I was in any massive danger of going down that road. But actually it was after I left, and partly through the process of Pompeii and experiencing it and its history and becoming more interested in the outside world and the politics and non-FIFA football specifically in its politics, that I started to learn a lot about colonialism and its impacts and what Britain had done in the world, and you know, the terrible things Britain had done in the world. And I think now I look back at it, I don't look back with any regret. I don't think I really behaved in a colonial way, but I really understand the sensitivity towards it. And it's funny because this same story of two white guys going over to a country in the middle of the Pacific and taking over a national team that doesn't exist, you know, trying to teach people to play football, actually already sounds different now than it would have done 10 years ago. But that's a good thing, you know, it's a very good thing that things know it. But it is interesting because I think whenever I talk about the story, I'm really keen to point out that, you know, I was the one learning. I was the butt of the jokes. You know, it was an experience of me being taught by the Pompeians infinitely more than I ever taught them. But I think we navigated it together, and yeah, I think it helped that I didn't want to be a kind of a coach authority figure in that way.
Yeah,
I was just not really ready for that, and it didn't make me happy. So I kind of wanted the players to be friends. But I also knew that at certain points you had to be something of an authority figure, otherwise you're not going to be able to coach people.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah. But I mean, I guess it's super interesting because there was also, I don't know whether you saw it, but the documentary Next Goal Wins, which tells the story of Thomas Rongen and American Samoa. And there was also a question I had that suddenly, like, this guy from Holland comes there and has a clear vision of what he wants to achieve and certainly brings a lot to the players, but also takes a lot from the island personally and in the way of living life. So it seems to be like an exchange can be possible between the players and their cultures and then the ideas that are brought in from abroad. So, yeah.
I think partly what it depends. I think a coach that wants to go abroad and work, whether it's in Federated States or Micronesia, or whether you're coaching Real Madrid, like you've got to go over and understand that there's a learning process there. It's not you're not going out there to build a team in your own image, devoid of the culture you're going into. And I think I understood that, luckily, not through any great skill or, you know, any knowledge that I had at the time, any wisdom. But I think I learned that. I knew that because I think I was lucky because I knew that I couldn't do it the other way. I wasn't a good enough young. I wasn't a good enough coach. I wasn't old enough. I couldn't have gone out there and been Sam Allardyce and, you know, said, you know, this is how we're playing. We're playing like this. You know, and tried to make a Bolton Wanderers team out of those guys if I wanted to. So luckily, I think I went in knowing that I had to learn, knowing that I had to be humble about things and understand the culture. And luckily, I already had that advantage of being not a good enough coach to do it any other way. And now I look back, I know that even if I was a much better coach, that's still what you'd have to do. But I can see why people fall into the trap of thinking that authority must, you know, you have to have authority and you have to portray yourself a certain way. And I actually learned this a bit later in Mongolia, where I approached things very similar way as Micronesia, and it didn't work so well because people wanted me to be effectively a despot. They wanted me to be a sort of Soviet-style drill sergeant, and I wasn't. And it really actually didn't work very well in Mongolia, which was a very interesting insight for me, was learning that certain places people want you to behave that way, and if you can't, if it's not in your nature, you're going to really struggle.
So after you had assembled the national team and you took them on this tour to Guam to get their first ever victory, what did it like feel like when you won the country's first game? Was that sort of the entire highlight of the entire trip, or how did that kind of feeling come about?
The bit that I struggled to get across now to people, and I suppose it makes sense, is we'd set this tour of Guam as our target. We speak to Guam FA and they said, look, you can play against a Guam under 17s, under 16s team, you know, you really don't want to play a national full team, and we agreed, you know, we didn't have any purpose. And then we'd assembled these other games against a second division team and two against other first division teams in Guam. And so we'd always had our eyes on the fact that we really needed a win, even though, you know, obviously there's so much more to life than that. The fact is there was a huge stigma about the fact Pompeii never won. And also that we'd go home and people would see, there was this tendency to see Pompeii as not being able to succeed in team sports, and especially so if we'd gone home with massive defeats, it's very possible that everyone would have thought, well, what was the point in that, let's give up. So we needed a win, and what was terrifying was we had no idea what the level was, because we were so in isolation. As I said, like, the best we could do was play Pompeii versus foreigners 11, but that would often include, like, you know, 50-year-old who had just had knee surgery, or, you know, like, there was no way, or me, even worse, me. So, you know, there was no way of really trying to get an idea of how.
So, how did you know how far down the pyramid to go to kind of have a good chance of a win?
In Guam, but the Guam FA just offered us teams, and we took them. You know, it wasn't really a relationship where we could have. I'm not even sure there was much below the Guam second division. I think we took a team that had been relegated from the first division and two that were in the first division.
Yeah.
But I think really a case of Guam FA went away and got teams who were willing to play us, and we just took it. And I think we were in a very, like, we were like the junior partner there. So whatever they offered us, we were going to take. And so we had no way of knowing what these players were like, what the level was. And so there was this fear going into Guam that however much we'd really trained, and, you know, we were at that point training in some capacity, whether that was like active or sort of more kind of studying training, we were doing 5-day week training sessions. We were in a gym at 5 a.m. in the morning when it was cool enough to be in there. You know, we were properly working hard.
Yeah.
We had no idea if we'd get out and lose 30-0 in every game.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's nothing to gauge it against. And so the fear of us getting thrashed every game was so huge that actually we did lose. I think we lost 3-2 in the first game, and we squandered some chances. And then we got into this second game, and they were just they had no idea what they were up against in terms of, for them it was just a kind of pre-season friendly for a pretty much, I imagine, amateur Guam, who were just guys with jobs.
Yeah.
You know, they come down to this game and we were just pumped up. You know, we were in the dressing room, they were like belting out their like the Pompeian chants, and we were thudding on the walls of the dressing room. And you know, they came out and we went, I don't remember when we scored the goals, but we went 6-0 up.
Yeah.
And I, no word of a lie, I think at about 75 minutes, we conceded to go 6-1. And I'm stood there on the sideline just going, don't give this away. Do not give it. And I'm just pacing,
yeah,
and I'm nervous and I'm sweating. Yeah. And now I look at it, I'm embarrassed, but genuinely, a bit of my brain was like, could you imagine if we gave this away?
7-6 loss.
I mean, that would be the end of football on the island forever.
Yeah. You don't recover from this.
Down in like folklore for years to come. We were 6-0 up even, and we lost. So yeah, we won that one 7-1, and it was nice because there's quite a lot of Pompeians in Guam, and loads of them had turned up to help feed our players, and you know, they brought food every night and they'd come and have an evening with the players and chat to them, and so there was like this mini pitch invasion of like Pompeians in Guam. And like players, you know, players with flags, players in tears, and it was like this most tiny thing that no one else in the rest of the world cared about, but it just so much this little group of players.
And yes,
there was something quite special about that. I think like it, I almost, the more the world didn't care, the more special it felt that this thing had happened.
No, we have like a very good comparison from, you know, when we covered the film Next Goal Wins, and we talked to Nicky Salapu, the American Samoan goalkeeper who was in goal when they lost 31-0, and he talked about like the feeling they had when they won that game, his first win against Tonga in 2015, and like the pure joy it had for him. And I've like listened to people who were at that game, and there's like five people there and like no one cares, but like it was for those stories, it was like players, it was their World Cup final and their story.
It meant the world to them.
Yeah,
for sure. And it meant that when they went home, they were treated differently for our players. You know, going back to Pompeii was like they'd won a game, and no one really cared if it was against the Guam second division team, or you know, it was against a team and they went off the island to Guam and they won, and it was like I think quite a big moment really.
But yeah, but was this the point when you crushed the Crushers, because I think they were called Crushers. Some question. No, but was this the point where you finally were like, okay, I've managed all that I set out to do? Because it feels like throughout the book, it's always something you manage to set up the league, but then you're not actually so sure whether you'll get financial aid and funding for the trip to Guam, but you kind of already told the players that that's going to happen next. So it kind of feels like you're constantly in this thing where you have to make yet another thing happen. But then when finally you win like the first international match for the team or with the team, then it kind of feels like, okay, now you can check off the list, last thing of the list, and have this feeling of, okay, I've come here and I have achieved what I set out to do.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, actually, we'd become really aware that we had to create something sustainable, and to do that, it had to be more than, you know, it couldn't be run by foreigners because we couldn't live our lives there forever. It'd been 18 months, you know, had to get on with my life.
Yeah.
I'd also run into 10 grand's worth of debt, like 10k in debt because of this project, which was never coming back, and I had to work my way out of that. I knew it. But you know, I needed to move on with my life. I had my girlfriend here who's now my wife, luckily.
Glad to hear that. Because when I was reading the book, and then you're like, something like sounded different in the way she told her stories, like that one week, and I was like, oh no, I mean, it's long distance and it's at the other end of the world, but then you're like, And then I found out it was the swine flu, and I was like, oh, that's super bad too, but also glad that still the long distance thing works out.
Yeah, that's not what I said to her when she said she had swine flu. After that, I thought I was getting dumped. You know, we got to the end of this thing, and she had sacrificed a lot, you know, being behind me for this. I'd borrowed money from friends, from family, from the bank, you know, and that was, you know, that's how the project could run. And then me and Matt, we know we had to get on with our lives, and
yeah.
More importantly, we didn't want to do something that was like a flash in the pan and it's gone and it's an anecdote. So we always had this in mind that after Guam we would leave, and that the players by that point, the key players who had been with us all that time, would have learned everything we knew, which wasn't a massive amount, but they'd learned enough to coach and to run a team that they would go back and be that generation that would then continue. So we were pretty happy knowing that we were going to leave with 16 coaches, basically. They would go back to their community and they would all have that enthusiasm. They may not all do it, but they were 16 people who were gonna bring that game and take it to another generation. And that pretty much is what happened. But the thing that I always thought was gonna happen too was that during the process we'd been involved on the edges slightly, but we'd helped be involved in setting up the Micronesian FA. So the four islands that had to be one unit in order to get any FIFA assistance,
yeah,
had set up an FA again. They'd had one in the past, but it had been inactive. They'd set an FA and they'd started the process of trying to get into FIFA via Oceania football and eventually Asia football. And my feeling was always, as we left, I was actually on a bit of a high, because I thought, you know what, this island's going somewhere. Eventually it's going to get the development help it needs, and it won't need people like me. But in the short term, hopefully it won't need people like me, because it'll have these players and they'll go back and they'll run their own football programs. And so I actually left feeling pretty positive about Pompeii and actually really quite negative about my prospects. But the book, someone once read the book and said, I didn't like the ending because it feels very low key and then a bit depressing. And I was like, well, it's not a fiction. Like,
yeah.
I left feeling there wasn't.
Yeah, this person is wrong, but.
I get what they're saying. I think what they're picking up on is when I write the book, at the end of that experience, I felt very low about aspects of it, because it's a project you've thrown yourself into for so long, and I was kind of walking away and thinking, massive debt here. I don't know exactly where this is going to lead. I've got to go home and find an actual life now. You know, a proper sustainable adult life.
Yeah.
And so I think I was feeling pretty low about it, but I always felt like we'd left the pieces in place that it was going to kick on. And actually it's amazing looking now from 10 years distance that there's been no further assistance from FIFA in any regard.
Yeah,
that for me is like one of my biggest sadnesses in life. You know, it's something that does definitely linger over me sometimes, is I would never have believed that was possible. Even with my slightly more cynical me after 18 months of trying to get in touch with FIFA, I never would have believed it could be this long.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said online, like I think you said on Twitter, that maybe it would be a different thing if now they would try to reach out to the Oceania Football Association and try to make something work with them.
Maybe. There's a lot of talk, but there's always a lot of talk. There's definitely talk that the new Oceania Football Confederation is more inclusive and is more interested in engaging the other islands. But the reality is it's never been proactive, and it remains not proactive.
Okay.
So the thing that always frustrated me was that there are partly that the process is completely unclear. There's no solid guide to what you have to do to get into Oceania Football.
Yeah.
There's not like a tick box, which you think there could be, like a series of stages. But the other frustration is that there's no proactivity in that, like, if you think of an island or a series of islands in their region, would get in touch and say, look, we're really trying to develop football the best that we can. Here is evidence of us doing that. We need your help.
Yeah.
It should be really the responsibility of an organisation with that much manpower, clout and expertise and money,
yeah,
to say to them, well, look, let us help you get where you need to be for us to provide you with the development systems. But instead, it's quite the opposite. They sit back and seem to wait for you to deliver to them evidence of the fact you're already at this level, you know, that we're already a totally competent,
yeah, which makes zero sense if you want to develop the game in these places, right?
It's just a horrible catch-22. It's like, you know, if we could have got to the if we could be as developed as somewhere like Samoa, then we wouldn't need the help. Like, we would obviously have things go. It was that, you know, we were going to them and saying, look, this is an island with like limited social opportunities for young people, with massive obesity rate, one of the highest in the world, with, you know, type 2 diabetes is a huge issue here, there's a lot of problems with substance abuse. We didn't say anything to them, but, you know, go back to, and you're looking at an island with that as a background and saying, what we think we can, you know, we've developed this sport, it's going well, it's growing, and people are keen on it, we just need to secure some help. And it wasn't even us saying it as foreigners, it was us providing the assistance to local people to build that communication out there. And there was nothing. It was not only nothing, there was just a clear desire to slow the process down so that we, you know, people would just drift away. And that's what happens in a lot of these islands, is the reason they're not in FIFA is because they generate some momentum like we did, and then they get no, and they get held up, and they get held up, and they get held up, and then the people who were generating the momentum disappear.
Yeah. And I guess that is part of the sad story, right? That is part of the sad ending, that you don't know whether this will ever happen, and whether there's like a clear pathway towards it where you can like progress on. But do you think how are the spirits on Pompeii itself? Because we checked, and it was actually in the 2015 Pacific Games that they participated with the other islands,
the under 23 team,
with the under 22 and 23 team, but it was not the most successful tournament, I guess.
So that's kind of a long story. I don't know how much of that you want to get into. Basically, so Federated States of Micronesia got themselves a little bit more organized, as I said, as a one unit representing the four islands, Pompeii being one of them. One of the few tournaments it has got access to is the Pacific Games, where there's like a multi-sport event, and one of them is football. So they were invited to send a team to Papua New Guinea, and it's a Olympic qualifier for, you know, for all the other teams in the region. And so you'd look at some of the strongest teams, like New Zealand send their under-23s, Fiji are there, Vanuatu, like real heavyweights in the region. And the Federated States of Micronesia opted to send a team as a kind of statement, say, well, look, we're serious. Hopefully, you know, the results were never going to be good, but they thought, well, let's send a team as a demonstration of willing. And as far as that went, I mean, I was long off the island by then. I was 4 years gone. But I really agreed with that in principle. But the thing that, where it went really horribly wrong, is that there's always a situation where, because the islands are so detached, it's very hard to merge a team from all of them. So what happened in the end was that on Yap, one of the other islands, where there was by that time a pretty active football program, the coach there basically decided, was given the chance to form the national team, and barely picked any Pompeii players. In fact, he picked almost all of his like young kids.
Okay.
I think two Pompeians went, one of whom was Roger, in fact, one of the players in our team who became a kind of superstar player. But the team was just this rookie team of really inexperienced players. The rationale officially was, well, these guys are so young that they can use this as a development process. But it was horribly mismanaged. It was by no means even close to the strongest team in Micronesia, which is absolute craziness when you look at the fact, if you pick the strongest team in Micronesia, really drilled them, said, look, this is how you line up, this is damage limitation.
Yeah.
They probably lost between 15 and 20 nil to teams like Fiji, because they would, you know.
Yeah.
Fiji, they're looking at a 50 or 60 year developmental disadvantage, and about, you know, however many hundreds of thousands a year disadvantage in terms of funding. But instead what they did was picked a team that barely knew the offside rule. They didn't actually have a trained goalkeeper, and I've been told since, I don't totally know if that's even true or whether it's that they're trying to deny responsibility, but basically they sent out a team that were lambs to the slaughter under this coach, this Aussie coach who'd been on Yap, and they got absolutely destroyed. I mean, they got the kind of defeats that get you in the joke. You know, they were the joke and butt of the joke on social media, and a lot of these players, it really hurt them. I think a lot of them probably gave up football. I know the guys from Pompeii didn't like to talk about it much. It was humiliation.
Yeah.
But more than that, losing 30 or 40 nil to anyone, It's not developmental. You know, you don't come back from that and think, oh, that's really motivated me to kind of get training.
Not at all, yeah.
No. And so for me, it was like, I got the idea. They wanted to show winning. They wanted to send a team.
Yeah.
They knew there was going to be a defeat, but it hopefully would bring the attention of OFC, because you'd be like, well, here we are competing in a tournament full of OFC teams. You know, surely something's got to give. But the execution of it was horrific, and it demonstrated two big problems in Micronesia. That one of them is that you've got these four islands with their own agendas and with their own people trying to merge into one team despite being separated by thousands of miles and very expensive airfares. It's always going to be a battle to do that. It's completely unrealistic.
Yeah, of course.
Really, for them to form teams, one single team. But the other problem is just, you know, quite simply that in the end they had the wrong set of players out there, and yeah, it did more harm than good. I think in a way it actually probably set football back a considerable distance.
Yeah, it looks quite bad, because the full games I think are on YouTube, but they're also like hurt by the format in that it's a four-team group with the top team going through, so all the three teams are playing for goal difference, so you have the kind of weird circumstance that I think of, like, I'm not sure, I think it's Vanuatu beat them 46-0, but they scored like their 32nd goal and they're running to grab the ball to go back to the halfway line to get going again.
It's a nasty system, and I mean, part of what I would think is, in a way, what would be much better for the developmental, for teams in that region, would be competition with the other non-FIFA teams. So, you know, Kiribati are much better, but, you know, Kiribati, and then you've got Niue, Nauru, you know, Palau, places where there are embryonic and, you know, pretty lapsed football programs, but where if they competed against each other, they would be pretty equal. And similarly to that, in Micronesia, you have the micro games, which is a sort of Micronesia just for the four islands and the surrounding islands. You have a kind of series of competitions, and one of them is football. And so in that, Pompeii won that in 2010, in 2012, and I think 2014 they won that too. So that was the crazy thing. In 2014, just before this farce in Papua New Guinea, Pompeii had won that tournament against Yap, against Chuuk, and against who else turned up, Palau, and that was all, you know, local based, and the competition was really fierce, and it was like most games were sort of 2-0, 3-0, 3-1 proper football scores, and that was a great developmental experience, that participation against teams of a similar level, brilliant. But the craziness of then saying, well, this team just won that competition, we'll barely pick any of those players. It's awful, and it still makes me really sad, because it was just such a wasted opportunity, I think.
Yeah.
The team that we had in Guam, if obviously you couldn't have picked that whole team, because that would be very politically divisive, just a Pompeian team, but had we entered that team in that competition, we, with a solid amount of coaching from people who knew what they were doing, or even me, you would have lost sort of 15-0 against Fiji, maybe, or maybe 20 nil, but no one would have been talking about that on social media.
You know? No, so how's the situation now? Like, what's the outlook? If FIFA is not responding, and if there are these problems with the whole Federal States of Micronesia team, then how do they keep the spirits up in Pompeii?
Well, the sport's still growing slowly. There's a lot of, you know, the league grows on the islands. It's a bit in a plateau now. I think it needs something new. So a couple of years ago, a British coach called Chris Smith went out. He was a guy who I spoke to him a lot, and he basically wanted to go out and volunteer and spent 3 months out in Pompeii and coached, I think, over 400 kids and helped schools learn how to put on sessions and did an amazing work. So yeah. I've got a charity that I set up that's called Uncharted Football, and the idea is that we try and assist any coach that wants to go into the region to work with the local sort of football people, whether that's an FA or whether that's just local sports authorities in any part of that region, and the idea is then that creates a sort of sustainable development. In the meantime, we also try and advise on any developments in the FIFA, you know, FIFA situation, whether there are, you know, we help make representation to OFC, we help make representation to AFC, whatever they choose to do.
Yeah.
But it's difficult, because the fundamental problem is the same problem has been. It costs, from Europe or even the US, it costs almost £2,000 or you know, return to get to these places. So it's very hard to find a volunteer, help them raise that money and get them out there. It's just proved really, really difficult. But if we can get enough people, you know, this year we had quite high hopes pre-COVID. We had quite high hopes for sending more coaches into the region. And the idea, again, just work with the local people who are developing football, sustainable skill transfer, and then just try and keep that momentum going. And at the same time, explore whether there are pathways starting to emerge within the FIFA fold. But this year has had slightly different plans, so we're slightly in a limbo.
Is Dilshan still on the island, or is he still coaching?
No, he's in the USA now. Okay. Actually, a lot of the players like a significant percentage of our players are now in the US. Because Micronesia being in the sphere of influence of the USA, it's... any Micronesian is entitled to travel to the USA and can study there and can work there. So it's a lot of Micronesians, when they're quite young, the age of our kids, you know, going into 20s, often go to the US and then work there or study there and then come back to Pompeii when they're a bit older. So I'm really excited, actually, when this generation of like our players start to come back and have kids in Pompeii. I think they're going to have a really big spike in ability there.
Well, I'm conscious that we've taken a lot of your time already. So, but I was just curious about what happened for you personally after Pompeii. I know you went and coached in Mongolia for a while, but is that a similar situation as in Pompeii, or what was that like?
I won't take up another hour of your time. Yeah, I did 3 years with the Mongolian team, initially coaching and then co-owning the team, and then that came to an end, and I joined CONIFA, which was basically the non-FIFA FIFA that represents sort of nation states and peoples not recognised by FIFA. And so I spent time, organised their World Cup in London in 2018,
which sounds incredibly interesting. Yeah,
that was an interesting experience. So I left there. The organisation took a bit of a downward turn in the last kind of year, so I left there. And then this year, I was supposed to be helping organise a Rohingya FA Cup in the camps in Bangladesh. But just a few weeks before the tournament was going to start, COVID really started to escalate, and we had to take the decision to postpone it indefinitely. And that's still sadly kind of postponed while we just kind of pray things don't get worse in terms of COVID in the camps. So my career is very much sort of focused on just trying to help people express identity through football and try and help people who aren't getting any assistance with football, really.
But in general, do you think, or what do you think football brings to all of these people? Because it seems to initiate something. It seems to create a spark, or at least a structure where you go to trainings every now and then, or where you can let out some of the emotions or whatever. Why do you think football is so important, especially for people that are struggling socioeconomically or just in general?
I think one of the big things I've seen is football about identity. And I think where football matters is where it still is about identity. So that's why it's why I feel like the superpowers of the game and the commercialization of the game, it's lost that soul, it's lost that purpose. So for me, where football matters is where it's people saying, this is who I am, and it has a value, look at me, express that. And I feel like where I have most enjoyed working, whether it's Pompeii or whether it's with the World Cup in London and having Tibet there, you know, watching the Tibetans sing their anthem, it's often about people being told, your identity does matter. You matter. And it doesn't matter whether you're trying to get a win against Guam. It doesn't matter whether you're trying to get your first ever goal and you're 30-0 down. It matters that you're putting on that shirt and you're representing who you are. And I feel like everyone should have the right to be able to do that, to pull on a football shirt, represent who they are, and every person who wants to do that is equally important. That for me is what I've seen, is how it brings out to people a pride and a sense of value and a sense of worth that often they don't really realize has been denied them until they get the chance to do it.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a brilliant message to finish up on. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Podcast Network.